Chapter 9. The Calvary Cemetery, located just off the Long Island Expressway, was a veritable forest of monuments and tombstones that seemed to stretch almost as far as the eye could see. Steele had spent the night there, as well as most of the following day after his escape from the federal marshals. The sprawling cemetery was completely deserted. Most of the remaining population of Long Island was centered around the enclaves, the one operated by the Pastore family in Queens near Forest Hills, the Delano Enclave in Brooklyn, in the Bay Bridge area near the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, the Bordini Enclave in Cold Spring Harbor, and the Enclave of the Castellano family in Long Beach. The eastern portion of Long Island was largely deserted. The only other concentrated center of the population was the Brood Enclave in Montauk and its environs. Here and there, in various deserted towns and villages, there were small, isolated bands of raiders and derelicts and nomads, doing what they could to scratch out a meager existence, living in the long-abandoned ruins of the city suburbs. There was no shortage of places to take shelter, so no one sought to bed down for the night in Calvary. And those who preyed on others tended to steer clear of the huge cemetery. They would find no living victims there, and it served as too grim a reminder of what their eventual fate would be. Steele had stopped there for the night rather than continue driving all the way to the end of the island, to the Brood Enclave, which had originally been his plan. He no longer knew what his plan was. All he knew was that Raven was dead. The pain of losing her was like a hot poker twisting in his stomach. He wished, not for the first time, but more than ever before, that he was capable of the cathartic, purging release of tears. But bionic optics could not cry. He thought of all the tears he hadn't shed. Tears for Susan Carmody, the first person who had ever looked at him and seen not a machine but a human being. She had helped him through the trying period of acclimation after his emergence as a cyborg. She had shown him love, only to be gunned down on the balcony of his penthouse by machine gun bullets fired from a helicopter hijacked by Victor Bordini's hitmen. Killed because she had been with him, because she had been in his arms when the attempt against his life had been made. Tear for his daughter, Corey, who had run away from home in Boston to visit him in Midtown, but who had been deceived by a man she took for a kind stranger, a grandfatherly, gentle-looking man who watched for innocent young runaways like her and made his living by gaining their confidence, buying them a nice hot meal and reassuring them, and then delivering them to pimps in no man's land. Innocent, beautiful, young Corey, who had been raped repeatedly until her dignity and self-respect had been stripped away, her personality destroyed, turned out on the streets to sell her body to respected citizens of Midtown, who told their wives they had to work late in the office and went out to no man's land looking for a thrill. He couldn't cry for Corey, who had died before he could rescue her, screaming his name. Tears for Mick Taylor, his partner and best friend, who had been riddled with assassin's bullets and rebuilt as the cyborg known as Stalker, only to succumb to madness and go on a killing rampage through the city, his insane cybernetic brain driving him to murder in a twisted effort to ease his pain. Mick, who had wanted desperately to die and who had died at his own hands. Tears for Dev Cooper, who had awakened his electronic alter ego in an effort to diagnose his troubles and who had descended into the abyss of drug abuse and alcoholism, tormented by his guilt over what he had unintentionally done. Dev Cooper, the psychiatrist who had tried to be his friend, who had stood by him and fought for him and who, in the end, had died for him. No one had cried for him. Tears for Oliver Higgins, who Steele had started off hating, but who in the end had proved to be a friend. A man who had thrown away everything he'd worked for in an attempt to help him. A man Steele had never really understood, but a man he came to respect. There was no one left to grieve for him. Tears for Ice, the powerful black giant whose real name Steele never even knew. Man who had once been his enemy, the leader of the savage street gang called the Skulls, who had struck a deal with Higgins, immunity, for prosecution in exchange for his help against Victor Bordini's illegal operations in the city. He had been assigned as Steele's partner over Steele's strong protests, And at first, the two of them had seemed to have nothing at all in common. Yet, Ice had accepted him for what he was, and the two of them had found an abiding friendship and respect. A camaraderie that only men who had been through the flames together could share. And now Ice, too, was dead. Steele remembered his last words.
Give him hell, policeman.
Defiance to the end. And tears for Raven, young enough to be his daughter, yet mature beyond her years. His life had been so cruelly hard and brutal that it would have destroyed most other women, yet it had tempered her, given her a quiet strength and a fierce resolve unlike anything that Steele had ever encountered. Ravenna Scarpetti, who had been seduced by Tommy Borodini at the tender age of 14 and who had been cast away into a degrading life of prostitution when Tommy B had been done with her. The young woman he and Ice had rescued from a gang rape by the Skulls and who had tried to kill him when he caught her robbing his apartment, who had been softened and been touched by the torment of his nightmares, who had held him in the night when he awoke, crying out in fear, and reassured him. Raven, who had given him her love, unconditional, uncompromising, who had stood with him through it all, fought by his side with the savage instincts of a beautiful young tigress, heedless of her own safety, and who had died trying to protect him. He would grieve for her as long as he had breath remaining in his body, and he no longer seemed to care how long that was. He wandered alone through the cemetery, and as the sun came up, he stood over a small grave marked with a simple tombstone. Chiseled into it were the words, Corey Steele, beloved daughter, September 30th, 2126 through September 27th, 2142. Rest in peace. She had died just 3 days prior to her 16th birthday. Janice had not objected when Steele asked to have Corey buried here, where he could visit her from time to time, instead of in Boston, where they had moved. Corey's death had shattered her, and dealing with her funeral was more than she could bear. Steele had not seen or spoken with her, or his son, Jason, since. But he often came to visit Corey and leave fresh flowers on her grave. He sat down on the mound and put his palm down against the hard-packed earth. Most of the graves were overgrown with weeds, the tall grass hiding their tombstones, many of which had been knocked over or defaced. There were no caretakers here anymore. But Steele kept Corey's grave from being overgrown. He had no flowers to bring her today, and he apologized to her for that. He told her that he loved her, that he hoped she was happy where she was, that he missed her terribly. And then his voice caught. He could not go on. He simply sat there for a long time, not moving, just staring off into the distance. And the hours passed until the sun began to sink on the horizon, staining the sky red. He thought about the people for whom no tears needed to be shed. Tommy Borodini. Rick Borodini. Victor Borodini. The list seemed much too short. There was one name missing. Bryce Carman. Carman and the people who were behind him, whoever they were. People who played with lives as impersonally as if they were pieces on a chessboard. People who paid lip service to the idea of morality, ethics, and the public good, while in their actions they cared about nothing but themselves. They couldn't be allowed to win, no matter what the cost. They had to be paid back in their own coin, starting with Bryce Carman. Doesn't matter anymore. Thought Steele. I've passed the point of no return. They've branded me a criminal, and after all that's happened, there's no way I'll ever be cleared now. There wouldn't be any day in court. But there would be a day of reckoning. They want a relentless murdering machine? Well, by God, that's what they'll get. In spades. He said goodbye to Corey one last time. He wouldn't be seeing her again. Her grave, untended, would now become overgrown with weeds like all the others. Perhaps they'd keep her warm. Perhaps, if he still had a soul, He might be seeing her before too long. He walked back toward the limo and got in. He turned the key and started the engine. And then he left the cemetery and drove back toward Midtown. Bryce Carman poured himself a drink. It was a first. The unaccustomed taste of scotch seemed bitter, but he swallowed it and poured himself another. His hands were shaking. It was all coming apart. McLennan had been arrested. He couldn't believe it. When he had called McLennan's office after coming back from Jennifer's apartment, he'd been told that the commissioner had been arrested and taken into custody by Captain Hardesty, and that no one seemed to know where he had been taken. A subsequent call to the district's attorney office had produced scarcely any more information, but it had been enough. The DA had not even been willing to speak to him, which was unprecedented, especially for a man of DA Patterson's ambitions. He was out of the office and could not be reached. There had followed a flood of calls from the mayor, half of the city council, four members of Congress, the chairman of the Zoning and Planning Commission, and at least half a dozen others, all in a state of panic. The media already had the story. Word was that the DA had cut a deal with McLennan, full immunity and witness protection in exchange for turning state's evidence. The papers were carrying the story under banner headlines. Charges of wide-scale corruption in city government. Carman implicated. McLennan to testify. Carman implicated. Jesus fucking Christ. Strikeforce had McLennan in custody, hidden away somewhere in some safe house. No way to get to him. Had no leverage at Strikeforce. Some lawyer named Powers was challenging this court decision on Steele's divorce, opening up the whole question of his legal status and the civil rights. And given the pressure from the media and the outcry of public opinion, the appellate court had scheduled a special hearing in 3 days' time, moving an entire backlog of cases aside, and it looked as if Steele would get his day in court. Based on that, the chief of Metro, acting in lieu of the commissioner, had canceled the order to have Steele shot on site. The only way they'd shoot him now is if he resisted arrest. It was all unraveling right before his eyes. Everything. There was nothing he could do about it. Try as he might, he could think of no solution. There was no way out. The phone rang. Someone else calling in a panic, terrified of being caught with his hands in the till. For a second, Carman thought of not answering it, but then he snatched up the receiver, anxious to lash out at someone. Anyone. What the hell do you want? He snarled into the phone.
My. Testy this evening, aren't we, Senator? And there we thought you had matters so well under control.
Carman swallowed hard. I'm sorry. I thought it was someone else.
Yes, that much seems evident. You sound a trifle strained, Bryce. Must be the pressure of recent events.
Look, I'll admit that there have been some minor setbacks, Carman began. But the caller interrupted him.
Minor setbacks? Now there's a classic understatement. You've bungled everything. We even tried clearing up some of your loose ends for you, but it seems that was to no avail. You've mismanaged things rather badly. That's very unfortunate. Very unfortunate indeed.
Look, I know it looks real bad right now, but the situation isn't hopeless by any means. I can still turn things around!
Really? How?
Carman opened his mouth, but could think of no reply.
Yes. It's about what we thought,
the caller said.
It's really a rather sad state of affairs. McLennan's going to talk, of course. And so will all the others, once they've found their ample posteriors in the ringer. Their fingers will all point to you. However, the buck stops there, Bryce. It must, you understand. It really would be somewhat awkward if you were to pass it. Can't allow that. I'm sure you understand.
Carman felt a cold fist squeezing his insides.
You know what must be done, Bryce. We're counting on you to have the grace to do it. We would appreciate it if you were to save us the trouble of taking care of it ourselves. Show a little class. Otherwise, you understand, we will be forced to take matters into our own hands.
No! You... You can't! Carmen stammered hoarsely.
One way or another, it will have to be done. It was simply felt that after all your years of service, the least we could do was show you the courtesy of giving you a choice. But don't take too long in making your decision, Bryce. You haven't got much time.
There was a click and the line went dead. Carmen dropped the phone. For a moment, he simply stood there, stunned. Then he rushed over to his closet and pulled out a suitcase. Without thinking, he began to stuff it full of clothes, just grabbing things haphazardly and throwing them in. Then he closed the suitcase and ran into the living room, over to the wall safe behind the mirror. He opened it and started taking out his papers, his bank account books, and bearer bonds, and the stacks of bills, the stainless steel, 9mm semi-automatic. The front door to his apartment suddenly burst open as it was kicked off its hinges.
Going somewhere, Carmen?
Stale. Carmen quickly racked the slide on the pistol in his hand, chambering around and aimed it at him.
Don't come any closer! It'll take a lot more than a few 9mm slugs to stop me, Carmen,
Steele said, coming toward him. Carmen fired. The bullet struck Steele in the chest. He kept on coming. Carmen fired again and kept on firing until the clip was empty. Steele reached out and snatched the pistol from his grasp. He held it up in one hand and squeezed, crushing it as easily as if it were an empty beer can. Carmen tried to lunge around him, but Steele caught him by the arm and swung him, throwing him across the room. Carmen struck the wall and fell to the floor.
Hold it, Steele!
Steele turned his head toward the door. Four federal marshals were standing in the doorway, their automatic weapons leveled at him. They looked extremely nervous.
I've got no quarrel with you, said Steele. But I'm telling you right now, even if you're loaded up with armor-piercing, I can still take out all four of you before I go down for the count. And I don't fucking care!
They exchanged quick, uncertain glances.
You'll never get away with this, Steele,
one of them said.
The alarm went out as soon as you busted past security downstairs. Reinforcements are already on the way.
Good! Why don't you go down and wait for them? Because anybody standing in that doorway 3 seconds from now is going to be dead.
He stared at them.
One. Two.
Fuck it. We aren't getting paid enough for this.
They quickly backed away out of sight. He listened to the sound of their footsteps rapidly receding down the hallway. Then he turned back to Carmen, who was still lying on the floor, moaning.
Get up! I can't. I'm hurt. I said get up!
He reached down and hauled Carmen to his feet.
All right,
Carmen gasped.
All right, you've got me. I'll talk, but I demand protection. Protection,
Steele said.
Not the police. I can't trust the police. It's got to be Strike Force. You've got to turn me into Hardesty. You don't seem to understand, Senator. I'm not a cop anymore, remember? I didn't come here to arrest you. I came to kill you.
Carmen stared at him with disbelief.
Come on! For Christ's sake, don't play games! What makes you think I'm playing games?
Steele threw him to the other side of the room, one-handed. Carmen cried out as he struck the opposite wall and fell down onto the couch.
Stop!
He pleaded.
God, I think you broke my arm! No more! Please! No more!
Steele crossed the room and hauled him to his feet again. Carmen cried out with pain.
Who's behind you, Carmen? Who's pulling your strings?
Carmen shook his head.
If I tell you, they'll kill me. I'll talk to Hardesty, only to Hardesty. You'll talk to me, you bastard, and you'll talk to me right now.
Steele tossed him across the room again toward the sliding glass doors leading out to the balcony. As Carmen struck the doors, they shattered, and the glass rained down on him, cutting him on the face and head.
Stop it!
Carmen screamed.
Stop it! For God's sake, stop it!
Steele stood over him. Carmen scuttled away from him onto the balcony.
Talk, you son of a bitch!
Steele said. Carmen shook his head. Blood was streaming down his face from the numerous lacerations caused by the broken glass.
Only to Hardesty,
he said, gasping for breath.
You gotta turn me over to Hardesty!
Steele leaned down and hauled him up again and bent him over the balcony railing.
It's a long drop, isn't it?
He said. He turned him around to face him.
Looks like your public's gathering down there. Maybe you can make a speech on the way down. Yo, crazy. Isn't that what you've been telling everybody? I'll talk to Honesty. I'll tell him everything. But you kill me, and you'll never know. I'll find out anyway.
He picked Carmen up by the neck and held him over the side of the balcony wall. Carmen's eyes bulged, and he made choking sounds as Steel held him out over the balcony, hundreds of feet above the ground.
Steel! Don't!
Still holding Carmen out over the balcony with one hand, Steele turned his face and saw Jake Hardesty standing in the apartment doorway, his hand held out. There were several men behind him, Strike Force officers in full riot gear, their weapons aimed at him.
Tell them to back off, Jake! Back off!
Snapped Hardesty at the men behind him. They moved back out of sight. A large crowd had gathered in the street below, and there were Strike Force and Metro units pulled up in front of the building, lights flashing. Several choppers hovered overhead. Carmen was making a hideous gurgling sound.
Steel! Stop! You're killing him!
Said Jake.
So what? You don't have to do this!
Said Hardesty.
Listen to me! McLennan's gonna testify! He's gonna turn state's evidence! We've got the voice print analysis on the dispatcher's tapes, proving that the calls were faked! We've got Carmen linked with Borodini! The DA can get him to confess! How? By offering him a deal, like he did with McLennan? So he pulls maybe 10 years and gets paroled in 5? That's not the point, Steel! We need Carmen alive to clear you! I've got a lawyer working on your case! She's petitioned the court to recognize your civil rights! We can prove this whole thing was a frame right from the beginning! We can prove it! But we need Carmen alive to do it!
Steel glanced at Carmen and then looked back at Hardesty.
You know something, Jake, he said. It's just not worth it.
And he dropped Carmen over the side.
No!
Shouted Hardesty, but it was too late. Carmen fell screaming to the street below, in full view of the crowd and the TV cameras, before he struck the sidewalk and splattered like a ripe tomato. Steel vaulted over the side of the balcony, catching the railing with his hands and swinging in toward the wall. Then he dropped straight down, catching himself on the wall of the balcony on the floor below, hauled himself up and entered the apartment directly below Carmen's. He ran through the apartment, past its frightened occupants, and out into the hall. He knew they'd be coming down after him in moments. He ran over to the elevator shaft and forced the doors open. The elevator was still on the floor above him. He extruded his gun barrel, snapped a steel dart into the end of it, clipped a nice steel line to it, and fired it to the bottom of the elevator. He heard shouts and footsteps running down the stairs. Bracing himself and winding the line around his wrist, he swung out into the shaft. The doors slid shut behind him, and the elevator started to descend. Hanging by one hand beneath the elevator, Steel descended with it down to the first floor. When it stopped, he let go of the line and dropped the remaining distance to the bottom of the shaft. He came out in the basement. He knew the building well. After all, he once lived here, on the penthouse floor, back in the days when he was entitled to share the same luxurious accommodations as senators and congressmen and high-ranking federal employees. It seemed like a lifetime ago. Knowing that the video cameras mounted in the corridor would give him away in seconds, he ran down the passageway leading to the underground shuttle that connected to the federal building, enabling legislators to ride back and forth in comfort between their offices and their apartments. As he ran across the small platform, the elevator and the stairway doors behind him opened, and a squad of federal marshals in full riot gear came running through. As they opened fire, he leaped down onto the tracks. Bullets struck the walls and whistled past him as he ran full speed down the narrow tunnel heading east toward the federal building. The tunnel curved a short way down, and for a while, he would be out of their line of fire. Several hundred yards farther down, there was a place where the shuttle tunnel intersected one of the old abandoned subway tunnels dating back long before the war. It had been sealed off with a heavy metal grill when the shuttle tunnel had been built, but Polly Borodini had discovered it when researching old city plans and used it to help his brothers engineer a kidnapping of some legislators. They had broken through the grill, blocked off the tunnel, and seized everyone aboard the shuttle, holding them for ransom. Steele remembered the case well. It had been what triggered his assault on the Borodini enclave, so that they could capture Victor and Polly Borodini and trade them for the hostages held by Rick and Tommy. After what had happened, the intersection with the old subway tunnel had been bricked up. Steele reached through the spot and started kicking at the wall, smashing to the old tunnel. Behind him, he could hear the shuttle. The marshals were going to use it to run him down. He kept kicking at the wall, making the hole bigger. The headlight of the shuttle lit up the tunnel all around him as it came around the bend. Automatic weapons fire echoed through the tunnel as the marshals fired through the window of the operator's cab. With a final effort, Steele smashed through the brickwork and plunged through the hole in the wall into the darkness of the old, abandoned subway tunnel. Switching his optics to infrared, he ran full speed down the ancient tracks. Behind him, the shuttle stopped and the marshals climbed down, came through the hole in the wall and opened fire, using the built-in night scopes on their weapons. But Steele was already about 100 yards ahead of them. And as the tunnel curved, he reached another intersection and took off down an intersecting tunnel, outdistancing pursuit.
"Why?"
asked Sharky wearily, leaning back in her chair in Jake's office and shaking her head.
"Damn it! We had Carmen cold. With McLennan's testimony and the testimony of the others, we had Carmen nailed. He could have cleared Steele. Why did he do it? Why did he have to kill him?"
Jake stared out the grimy window of his office.
"Because anything else would not have been enough,"
he said.
"Higgins dead! Cooper dead! Ice dead! Raven dead! Especially Raven! The best we could have had Carmen on was accessory charges! Conspiracy! Corruption! Steele knew what would have happened! Carmen would have been plea bargained! Justice would hardly have been served!"
"But he threw it all away,"
said Sharky.
"He killed Carmen in front of several hundred witnesses. Hell, the TV cameras caught it all. He was right there on the balcony in full view, dropping Carmen over the side."
She shook her head with resignation.
"It's all pointless now. The Appellate Court won't hear his case. And with Carmen dead, and the Borodinis dead, there's no one left to clear him of those murder charges."
"I don't think he cares,"
said Jake.
"So what happens now?"
Jake sighed and shook his head.
"I don't know. If he's smart, he's left the city. There's certainly no reason for him to ever come back here. He's got friends among those bikers at the Brood Enclave. They made him an honorary member once! Maybe he'll head there. No one's going to bother taking on the Brood to get to him. He'd be safe there. Maybe he can find life. I hope so for his sake. God knows he's been through enough."
"It's just that we were so close,"
said Sharky.
"Damn it all to hell,"
she sighed.
"I just wish to God he hadn't done it."
Jake looked at her.
"Counselor, if you tell anyone I said this, I'll deny it. But the truth is that I'm glad he did."
End of chapter.